You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, a look at how companies collect our medical data and make billions of dollars in the process.
First, Wisconsin's Group Insurance Board voted yesterday to make a switch to self-insurance for state and local government employees. The move has been heavily debated over the last few years. It would mean that instead of buying insurance from HMOs, Wisconsin would pay medical benefits directly for about 250,000 employees. Full disclosure, Wisconsin Public Radio employees are included in that number.
The plan still has to be approved by the state legislature's budget committee. If it is, it would go into effect at the beginning of next year. Justin Sidnor joins us now for a look at what that would mean. He's the Leslie P. Schultz Professor in Risk Management and Insurance and an Associate Professor at the UW-Madison School of Business. Justin, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, give us a schooling here, a working definition of self-insurance. What is it?
So, you know, I think the definition we heard right at the top is just right. The self-insurance just means that you pay directly for healthcare bills as they come in, rather than paying an insurance company at the beginning of the year for premiums.
And the money that you pay into your health insurance and your employer does, it goes into some trust fund, and the money to pay for your medical bills comes out of that fund?
That's right. So the state will have to keep a fund to budget for these bills and pay out of that fund.
And how would this impact us in our healthcare? What could be the impact?
So for most people, you won't notice a direct impact. So this shouldn't change how you access doctors. You'll still get bills for out-of-pocket costs, but the doctors will still bill the insurance company. It will look pretty much like all insurance has looked before.
But this move has been in the works a while and quite contentious. Why?
Well, I think the reason it's been contentious is that it does represent a fairly large change in a pretty complicated and, for all intents and purposes, well-functioning system. So this is a move away from a system using many different small insurers towards a system that uses a fewer number of larger insurers.
And Wisconsin has been called a very competitive health insurance market, which is healthy. What would self-insurance potentially do to that?
So I think in terms of the implications for the whole market, it probably won't be massive, but there could be some impacts to some of the smaller health plans. We can see this, for instance, here in Dane County, where Group Health Cooperative would not be part of the new plan, but was one of the smaller players in the current system.
Governor Walker framed this as something that will ultimately help save the state money in his budget address. Here's a clip.
The Commission on Government Reform, Efficiency, and Performance reports that 46 states have some form of self-insured plan, and nearly half of those states are fully self-insured, including our neighbor, Minnesota. As you think about this reform, consider this. Across our state, employers, healthcare systems, schools, institutions of higher education, and others are successfully using self-insurance plans to make healthcare affordable for their employees and to make their dollars go further. We can do the same. Moving the state to a self-insured plan, we believe, will save Wisconsin taxpayers at least $60 million during this budget cycle.
Do you see this as a move that will help Wisconsin tax dollars go further?
I think there's a lot of uncertainty about whether that $60 million worth of savings will arise or not. Most large employers, when they switch to self-insurance, do save a few percentage points on their insurance costs. And for a massive program like ours, those few percentage points can add up to millions of dollars. The thing that makes us a bit different is that we're starting from a very unique and different position than most large employers. We currently have a interesting competitive bidding model using 17 different insurers. And so this change for us is more complicated, and it's less clear that we'll get the same savings that typical employers do.
The same bang for the buck.
That's right.
Yeah. We're talking with Justin Sidnor. He's the Leslie P. Schultz Professor in Risk Management and Insurance and Associate Professor at the UW-Madison School of Business, talking about this proposal on going to self-insurance for state employees. Governor Walker mentioned Minnesota. Minnesota self-insures and 20 states self-insure all state employees. So what draws Wisconsin lawmakers to this model?
So I think the big appeal is that it potentially saves some money, that couple of percentage points, by avoiding the fees that insurers charge to bear the risk of the program. They also like the idea of getting more access to the healthcare claims data of employees that they might be able to use to change the program over time and improve benefit structures, that sort of thing.
But that could also have, if they can have the ability to change benefit structures, isn't that something scary for state employees?
So I think it's always scary when you talk potentially about changing benefits. I think the important thing to keep in mind is that currently we have seen changes to benefit structure. There's nothing that prevents changes from the benefits being made now. Self-insurance would potentially just make it easier to have good data about the consequences of that.
This would affect thousands of state and local employees and their dependents. How could this affect the health insurance market overall in Wisconsin?
So the big potential impact that, you know, that could ripple through to the rest of the market is that by taking employees away from some of the smaller insurance players and concentrating them in some of the larger insurance players, we might make the overall system less competitive. And that over time could lead to increasing costs. If, for instance, some small providers drop out of our market or get consolidated with some of the larger players.
That would be a potential drawback. Any other drawbacks that you see?
I think the big thing is that we don't really know very much about how this will actually end up affecting the negotiations and the rates we get with providers. So right now, the insurance companies that we pay for our insurance have an incentive to hold down those costs directly. The idea with self-insurance is that you'll pay these similar sorts of companies to bid for you with hospitals and doctors for good prices, but there's a lot of uncertainty about whether that new system will be as effective as the current system.
Democrats have considered this as another hurdle for public sector employees and something that will reduce choices for employees. Do you think that's true?
There will be some reduction in choice. There will be certain smaller plans and some providers that will drop out. Group health cooperative that we've talked about here in Dane County is an example. But it shouldn't need to be a massive change for employees.
And one board member estimated that insurance purchased for state and local employees is only 10 to 15% of the total insurance market. Will switching those people to self-insurance have a large-scale impact?
I don't think we should anticipate to have a very large-scale impact, but it may have these sort of small impacts that accumulate over time by making the market a little bit less competitive.
If this goes into effect on January 1st, 2018, what might the transition process look like?
I actually think for the typical employee, you may barely notice. So unless you're currently using one of the plans that's not going to be in the system anymore, this may not change much of anything for you. It should be pretty seamless.
What are you watching in the weeks ahead and as this plays out in the legislature?
The main thing I would like to see is actually a lot more detail on where these projections of the cost savings are really coming from. What assumptions go into those cost savings and what potential risks to those cost savings have been considered?
What are some of those potential risks, briefly?
So I think the main thing is just exactly how the bidding is going to work and where exactly we think we're getting those cost savings from.
Thank you so much for being here, Justin. Appreciate it.
Glad to be on. Thanks for having me.
That was Justin Sidnor. He's a professor in risk management and insurance at the UW-Madison School of Business. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, do you ever wonder how drug companies come up with names like Zocor or Cymbalta? We'll talk to an expert who will let us in on the complicated and mysterious process of naming new prescription drugs.
First, what's shared with your doctor stays with your doctor, right? Most people assume that what they tell their doctor is private, but that's not always true.
What a lot of people don't know is that every time they get a blood test or pick up a drug prescription, that information, with their names removed, may be collected and then sold by commercial companies who make billions in the process.
Patients may have very little say in this and find it difficult, if not impossible, to opt out of having their data collected.
Adam Tanner joins us now. He's writer in residence at Harvard University's Institute for Quantitative Social Science. He's the author of the new book, Our Bodies, Our Data: How Companies Make Billions Selling Our Medical Records. Adam, welcome to Central Time.
Good to be with you.
Well, what first clued you into this wholesale marketing of people's medical data?
I researched a book several years ago called What Stays in Vegas, and that's about the business of customer information that businesses gather about us to improve their sales and marketing. And a lot of that looked at what's going on in Las Vegas as well as elsewhere. I thought I would do a chapter in that book about medical data. I thought it would be relatively easy to tackle that subject. But it turned out to be so vast a trade, so many billions of dollars at stake, and so complicated that I set that project aside and then spent the last 2 years researching this basically hidden trade of all of our medical information.
There's a lot of medical information out there about us. Let's start with, you know, that trip to the doctor's office, maybe a little lab work or something like that. When I'm in there, I'm assuming it's between me and the doctor in the lab. What kind of information could actually go out and be sold?
Of course, you're right to assume that that's something that's been part of medicine since ancient Greek times, that you would be in complete confidence speaking with your doctor. But with the digitization of medical records has come the ability to spread this information elsewhere. Now, often that helps us. The doctor can easily send the prescription to the pharmacy or send the blood test results to and from other specialists. But at the same time, what is happening now is that many of these entities are selling this information about us to commercial data miners for use that's not related to your medical care. That information doesn't have your name on it. It has the name of your doctor. It has your birth date. It has your gender, what part of town you live in. But that information about you is gathered together over time to create a medical dossier about you largely for commercial purposes.
Right. It's anonymized, I think, is the word that you use in the book. It's anonymous data, at least in theory. How confident can we be that once our data goes out there to be mined, that it won't be re-identified with us?
The problem with anonymized data is that a single piece of data may be safe, but if you add many pieces of information about you over time, it's increasingly at risk to be re-identified. So it may be your doctor's office visit 3 years ago, and then a blood test you had a year ago, and then some prescriptions you had this year, and other information. If you add different pieces of information, such as different cities where you may have had medical care, then it becomes ever easier. So you take me, for example, I'm teaching for a year in Alaska in Fairbanks. So if you have medical records from me in Fairbanks, man, my age, my gender, and my part of town, added to where I lived before, which was Cambridge, Massachusetts, and before that, Belgrade, Serbia, where I was working for a few years, all of a sudden I'm likely the only person that could meet that profile, and thus you could re-identify me.
What's the damage to us as individuals if this data is out there, especially if our names get attached back to it?
So the damage could be several-fold. Firstly, most significantly, I think our confidence in the medical system might be undermined if we don't feel that we can fully disclose everything that's bothering us to our medical professionals. If you're worried that this information is in circulation, you might be a little less forthright. The other possible issues are some kind of discrimination or embarrassment. So, for example, employers might be interested in this information. Very expensive employees who cost them a lot through health insurance costs might be worth getting rid of, even though that's not allowed. Life insurance companies legally can deny you life insurance if they worry that you're going to be a very costly investment. You could have other kinds of people using it against you, such as in the political arena or in foreign affairs, or a jealous former lover or a jealous workplace colleague. All sorts of people could use this information for bad, and that's something that we should be concerned about, especially into the future as such re-identifications and use of this data becomes more possible.
You also write about how this can be used to market medications very directly to doctors, and you write about doctors being surprised to know how much drug company salespeople know about what they prescribe, how often they prescribe it. Can you talk about that?
So there is these dossiers that I first mentioned that are anonymized about us, the patients, but there are named dossiers about individual doctors by the hundreds of thousands across the United States. Drug companies use this to target their sales to doctors. So they may know that your doctor typically prescribes a certain brand medication, drug A, but drug company B may want to send their salesman and say, hey, doctor, we've got a great drug. Here's drug B. Let me give you some free samples. Let me take you out to lunch. So they could use that information in a sophisticated way to figure out what kind of patients the doctor has, what kind of drugs they typically prescribe, what kind of needs they have, and then target their sales pitch accordingly.
And here's a weird thing. You write, they may buy snacks, bagels and lox for the staff or something, and if the doctor doesn't prescribe enough of the drugs, they'll say, oh, sorry, staff, bagels are out. Your doctor's not prescribing enough of our drug. This actually happens?
Well, so some of the excesses of the past have been cut back somewhat, especially in the 1990s. There was a wild amount of incredible meals offered for doctors and food brought to the staff, to their staff and so on. But interestingly, the drug companies understood that if they would bring every week a big spread of luscious breakfasts and bagels and lox and all sorts of things to the staff, that if the doctor didn't prescribe enough of the certain medication, the staff would be discontent, and then the doctor would have to hear from the staff. So, of course, that's not necessarily in the interest of the patient. You, as the patient, want the doctor to prescribe the best treatment, and if possible, the cheapest treatment. Perhaps there's a generic that does the job just as well as the expensive name brand. So those are some of the tricks that have been used in the past by these big drug companies.
Talking to Adam Tanner, his new book is called Our Bodies, Our Data, How Companies Make Billions Selling Our Medical Records. An argument, a big data type argument in favor of this kind of thing, Adam, you address this in the book, is the idea that, hey, taking my anonymous data and yours and everybody else's, we can start to really use research, big data research, to find correlations between one disease condition and another, find out what treatments work, that sort of thing. Do we actually see that kind of benefit?
So the data miners, the companies that do this kind of business, and they include companies you've never heard of, such as Quintiles IMS, but also companies such as IBM Watson, LexisNexis, and some of the health insurance companies, they say that all of this big data will help advance science and medicine. So far, the insights that have come from it have been interesting, and an interesting cost analysis and things of that nature, but there haven't been major solving of diseases or major new drugs developed. What I would prefer to see, and I think it's worth talking about, is giving patients a choice as to what happens with the data. Right now, if it's anonymized data about us, if our name is removed, we have no say. And in fact, we're not even informed when that data is traded and sold about us. I think we as patients should have the say of what happens, and I think many people would gladly give it to science, to respected researchers and institutions, in the hopes that they can make use of it to help solve diseases.
What can a patient do, a healthcare consumer do, to try to protect information, to try to take control, or do we even have options at this point?
So this is where it becomes tricky. So if it involves non-medical data, how you use the internet, what information you share with retailers, and so forth, you do have some control. You can take more measures to protect your privacy. The problem is the kind of medical data that we're talking about here is sold without you even knowing about it within the system that we're talking about it. So the best way would be to change the rules on a national level to say that medical data is any information about a patient, whether or not it's anonymized. There is a second category of information that is name data about you that comes from outside of the doctor's office, named medical data. So if you subscribe to a medical magazine or some kind of ailment-related magazine, what you search for on the internet, what you say on Twitter, whether you wear fitness devices, some of that information can be sold. And so you should be sensitive, I guess, if you're concerned, as to outside of the doctor's office, what kind of medical information that you're sharing that could be used by others.
Can you talk about the scope of this data mining in health information? What kind of money are we talking about here?
So it's billions of dollars. The biggest data mining company is called Quintiles IMS. It's a company that's been around more than 60 years. It's worth more than $20 billion. It's a worldwide trade, and in many of the big developing countries, it's a very large major business, so in Europe and Japan, but even in developing countries, increasingly this has become a major business. And the reason's pretty straightforward. We spend hundreds of billions of dollars on drugs, and if companies can get more insights and help boost their sales, it's worth paying for this kind of information. So it's been around for quite a number of years, but it's becoming ever more sophisticated with these individual patient dossiers having been developed in the last 10, 15 years in a very sophisticated way.
Are there policy changes you'd like to see to clamp down on this a little bit?
So right now, the data that belongs to us or should belong to us is only that data which names us. So the HIPAA rules, which define how medical information about us can be traded and transferred, HIPAA rules say that your name's not on it, certain pieces of detail, such as your address or Social Security's not on it, it's not your data. I think we should update those rules to give you more say. I think there should be more transparency from the companies that trade our data to give us a say in what happens to it. I think we should also be encouraged to donate our data to science to help research for medicine and diseases, but I think we should have the say in that. So I think we really should empower people to have the choice whether or not they want to be sharing this information.
I want to wrap up on that point of transparency. Even for you going out and looking for this information, it sounds like in many cases, people didn't really want to talk about this.
I should mention a bit of my background. I spent 5 years covering the Kremlin as a foreign correspondent. I researched the 9/11 hijackers in Germany. I've done many investigative projects as a writer over my career. I've had to use those same investigative techniques to try to find out what happens with our medical data. It's a very lucrative business for these data mining companies, for the drug pharmacy companies that sell it, for many of the middlemen, and they would prefer not to reveal too much about it. I think they can still do a prosperous business and be far more open, and that's what I'm trying to do in this new book, Our Bodies, Our Data.
Adam, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
That was Adam Tanner, writer-in-residence at Harvard University's Institute for Quantitative Social Science. We've been talking about his new book. It's called Our Bodies, Our Data, How Companies Make Billions Selling Our Medical Records.
Coming up, we'll learn about the complicated process of naming new prescription drugs. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Farah. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Farad.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up tonight after 7, it's True Stories Told Live on the Moth Radio Hour. Tonight, professional gambler Annie Duke details a pivotal poker game at the televised Tournament of Champions. And road rage lands a new mom in jail. That and more tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, Kate, let's play a quick game. I'll say a word. You tell me if it's a prescription drug or a science fiction planet. Ready?
Uh-huh.
Remeron.
Okay, don't take it.
Drug or planet?
I'm going to go with drug.
It is a tetracyclic antidepressant approved by the FDA in 1996. Remulac, Conehead's planet from the famous Saturday Night Live skit.
So how do drug companies come up with the alien-sounding product names that end up on pharmacy shelves?
Susan Scooty joins us now with the story. She's a CNN health writer. Susan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. I'm happy to be here.
You've written on this. I used to work at a pharmacy, and I did have a game, Star Wars Planet or Prescription Drug. Can you give us a bit of the history on how drugs came to get their names?
Well, I mean, I think most of us would imagine that drugs have been around for a long time, since midwives and medicine men mixed tree roots and other substances. They probably named their drugs in some sort of way. But in more recent times, drug naming was like the domain of pharmaceutical companies. They probably, judging from what I can tell, they base their names on the chemical formulations. For example, Bayer's aspirin, a product created in 1899, is based on the chemical acetylsalicylic acid. So aspirin, acetylsalicylic, it sort of makes sense. But by the end of the century, by the end of the 20th century, names started to, I think Madison Ave was responsible for new trends in naming. That was around, David Wood was a pioneer in the field of branding. And according to Arlene Tech, a drug namer, he was a visionary because he saw brand naming as a wholly separate discipline in business on its own. And he is someone who began to market services of simply naming products. And that entered into pharma around the early 1990s, he's responsible for naming Prozac. Mm. You know, over time, the name shifted into, in the 90s, they were pretty much descriptive. You know, for instance, Wellbutrin is a drug from that time that suggests wellness. Flomax, as Scott Pierre Grossi, who's another drug namer, as he put it, Flomax, you don't have to guess what Flomax does. but basically, then if they shifted from functionality. Scott Pierre Grossi said that in the 2000s, we developed more Latinized drug names like Lucenta, Lipitor. Then in 2010, they began to become even more novel and strange. For instance, Xiidra, X-I-I-D-R-A, is an embalming product which is spelled X-I-I, uncommon letters.
Needs a pronunciation in all advertising.
Yes. So basically, Kate, you know, like over time, you know, they migrated away from functionality and sort of recognizable names towards more exotic sounds simply because there was such a backlog of names that they had to get more and more obscure and bizarre to get the FDA to approve them.
And Prozac, as you mentioned at the outset, was really a turning point. It really hit everything. Why was Prozac such a key name and a pivotal moment in drug naming?
I think it is because of David Wood. He's just everybody I spoke to mentioned him as just this, you know, as I said, visionary. He just saw naming as an entirely separate art form aside from marketing, and that was his baby. It meant, as Scott Pierre Grossi said, it meant nothing, and yet, you know, it had a good sound and people liked it. Obviously, it's an antidepressant. Maybe it was sort of uplifting. Our John Fidelino, who I also spoke with, he said, you know, it took a whole condition out of the shadows. People didn't want to talk about depression, but Prozac allowed them to do that. So I think that's part of what a good name does, is it elevates the product and the condition at once.
We're talking to Susan Scudi, CNN health writer, looking at how prescription drugs get those weird science fictional names. Susan, if I invent a candy bar or design a car, I can name it whatever I want. It can all be the marketing. If I design a drug, the FDA gets to weigh in on the name. What kind of things might they shoot down a proposed prescription name for?
Okay. The FDA is all about safety. The division that works on the names is called Division of Medication Error Prevention and Analysis. So that sort of tells you everything. Their goal is that we do not, that a name is unique enough, it doesn't look alike or sound alike any other drug and cause confusion. There are so many points of confusion after all. Your primary care physician telling a nurse, you know, the nurse practitioner to write up a script for X drug. They don't want to say that, they don't want a name that can easily be confused by another one. There's another aspect of why the FDA might shoot a drug name down is brand names cannot include groups of letters known as stems that generic names must include to signal what class of drug they are. So there's all sorts of odd little two-letter, three-letter, and four-letter configurations that cannot be included in a name. OS, for instance, that cannot appear within a brand name ever. The FDA also reserves the right to nix names for seeming too fanciful, or if they stigmatize a patient or the condition, or if they overstate a drug's effectiveness. So based on all that, the FDA is killing about 40% of names that are even handed into it.
A lot of rejection out there. So there's the chemical name, and then there's room for making room for the generic name before you get to the brand name. So how does the generic name factor into all of this?
Yeah, the generic name is not ultimately, the company, when a drug is known by three names. Its chemical name, its generic name, and its brand name. The chemical name is based on the molecular structure of the drug, and that's chemistry. So that's not exactly, the scientific name is not exactly a name, is not exactly something we would say is named. It's really just described. The United States Adopted Name Council proposes a generic name, which has to be approved by the International Non-Proprietary Name Program run by the World Health Organization, so that all throughout the world, a generic drug is one and the same. So there's no confusion there. So really, the company then only works on the brand name, which is all about trademarking and marketing.
And as I understand it from your writing, the prescription drug company in itself may not be the one who comes up with a name. They outsource it to these naming experts, often at one particular company.
Yes. It's a whole niche in the advertising market. As you mentioned, Pierre Grossi said of his company is Brand Institute. He says 75% of names come through his door, but when he says that, it means that in some form or another, sometimes the services of naming can be small. For instance, a company may want to sort of name it in-house, but then they'll use one of these smaller advertising agencies, these boutiques, to run a focus group or to just help with what do doctors think of this name, or to tweak it slightly. So it's, even though that quote is kind of, even though that seems high, that the Brand Institute is working on 75% of all names, it seems to me that a lot of pharmaceutical companies divvy up this work among different boutiques, and work with them to find what they think of as the best name possible. So I think a lot of them, the work is so specialized. I sort of strayed from your question, but because the FDA has so many constraints and regulations, and naming is very difficult. That's why this whole industry of smaller ad agencies developed.
Is naming so difficult because they are so concerned about medical errors and about getting lookalikes and soundalikes where that could lead to a medical error, an overdose?
Yeah, definitely. With 1.5 million Americans, with almost half of American adults taking at least one prescription drug in any given month, about 1.5 million Americans are sick and injured or killed by errors in prescribing, dispensing, and taking medications, according to the Institute of Medicine. So the whole idea is we got to get the name straight because it's just so easy to make an error.
So Susan, as we wrap up, is there a concern that as more and more drugs go on the market, we're going to hit peak name and run out of combinations of Z's, Q's, and X's that can pass FDA muster?
But none of them said that to me. Namers are the most unique bunch of people I think I've ever interviewed. I mean, they are just the trippiest, funniest people. They are they both reverse engineer and, they're both creative and yet highly technical people. They seem to think there's an endless supply of combinations, letter combinations they can come up with. So, I mean, I put my faith in them, and I think everything should be fine. But they have all sorts of, they've broken it down into, bizarre letter abstractions. I mean, to them, it's no longer even words so much as letters that they're looking at and working at. And they look at each of them has their favorite names of, and they've come up with them, by combining words, combining letters, just doing what they do.
We'll leave it there. Susan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Kate and Rob.
That was Susan Scuti, CNN health writer. She shared the story of the complicated and mysterious process of naming new prescription drugs.
This is Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a look at education spending in the governor's new budget proposal.
First, a Wisconsin lawmaker is sponsoring a bill that would fine so-called sanctuary cities up to $5,000 a day for not cooperating with federal immigration enforcement. The bill is similar to one that passed the Assembly last year, but it didn't come up for a final vote in the Senate.
Well, the definition of a sanctuary city isn't always clear. Madison has policies often associated with sanctuary cities when it comes to immigration enforcement. On Tuesday, Madison's Common Council adopted a resolution designating public libraries and city council offices as safe places where residents can get phone interpreter services and immigrant rights information.
We talked with Republican Janelle Branston earlier this week about her proposal to penalize communities that fail to enforce immigration laws. She represents the 22nd Assembly District, including Menominee Falls. Representative Branston, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you for having me on today. I appreciate it.
Under this bill, how would counties and municipalities be punished for adopting a sanctuary policy or refusing to cooperate with federal immigration laws?
Well, the bill simply just says that the municipalities need to follow the federal law. It's really that simple. So the point of the bill is that we have these laws in place. It becomes dangerous when we go into the process of selectively enforcing. So what this bill just says is we have to uphold federal law. And if municipalities choose not to, they can be sued by any taxpayer, DA, anybody. So there's pure transparency in the sense that they're being upheld through the court system by any individual or group has the right to sue them for a penalty of, depending on the size of the city, between $500 and $5,000 a day. So the point is that it is truly in the hands of the people to make sure that their municipalities are upholding their laws.
So would this bill open up a lot more opportunity for litigation, making it easier for anyone to sue any county for adopting a sanctuary approach?
Pretty much. Like I said, it is the transparency rule. And the whole point is, you know, everybody deserves to live in a safe community. Safety, regardless if you're legally or illegally. I mean, everyone, every family deserves to be in a safe community. And so by not upholding our federal laws, you know, we are still dealing with criminals, with gang members and drug dealers. You know, Wisconsin has been really hit hard by drug activity. I mean, and we've seen it in our youth population. So for a municipality to say, you know what, we're not worried about making sure that we're getting gangs and drug dealers off the streets, that's not our priority. Of course it's their priority. And like I had mentioned before, you know, the process of saying, hey, we're going to uphold this law but not that law, that's really dangerous territory for any municipality to get into, in the sense that, you know, we are a nation of laws, and they need to be applied equally. Now, if there's a larger conversation about this law is too hard for us to uphold or there's additional funding that's necessary, this is a great time to have that conversation, and we'd be glad to do that. But specifically, with real specifics about what the concerns are. But again, we are a nation of laws, and we want to make sure that we're upholding a law for everybody to have a safe community.
Well, Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark has said he plans to participate in President Trump's local immigration enforcement effort. But Madison, on the other hand, is going a different direction, considering a resolution that would prohibit the use of city resources for enforcing federal law on this and perhaps making even city council offices safe spaces. What do you think of these drastically different views and approaches on immigration enforcement happening inside Wisconsin?
Well, I think a lot of this goes back to the selective enforcement. And if one community is going to choose to uphold laws and another not, that's where we come to this problem. And that's why we've made these communities difficult to enforce, because we've had one group of people that are going to follow the law and another group not. So, I mean, that's the whole point of this bill. Either we're going to uphold our federal laws as they exist, or let's come together and have a conversation about what the issues are. And in fairness, there were between, estimates of 2 to 3 million people that have criminal records and gang members and drug dealers. I mean, I don't care where you live or what your family structure is. Nobody wants those type of individuals on the street and, you know, not having that opportunity to bring them in for families. That's a dangerous precedent.
This bill is similar to one that was pushed last year. There were a number of protests, though, last year. And do you feel you have enough momentum this time around to break through the opposition on this?
Well, you know, last bill was done by Representative Spiros and Senator Knoth, and they keyed in on the law aspect, you know, by saying upholding all federal laws that exist. You know, that's not only about safety through the immigration laws, but also, you know, we're talking about the opportunity to protect our job opportunities, you know, the fiscal costs for welfare benefits. These are all things when you declare yourself a sanctuary city, I don't know what that means. Are you turning your head to making sure that people have proper identification for voting, for public benefit, for welfare costs? And, you know, we also want to show integrity for our legal immigration system. So when you declare yourself a sanctuary city, I have no idea what laws are going to be upheld and which ones are not. And that's what I said, the risk of a safe community. We need to uphold all our federal laws. And if there is some discussion that needs to be held at the table, we can to do that.
So let's say all this legislation goes through. Would Madison be at the top of the list for penalties? And what would that look
that
like?
That would be up to groups or an individual who wants to hold them accountable. Remember, this all goes back to our court system and allow them to be upheld by that. This isn't something that I would do or, I mean, any person, and that's just any resident, would have the power to uphold the laws within their own communities. So again, the power goes back with the people to go back and be able to enforce those laws.
We're talking with Republican State Representative Janelle Branston, who represents the 22nd Assembly District, including Menominee Falls. She's reintroducing a proposal to penalize communities that fail to enforce federal immigration laws. And now, Representative, you're a businesswoman. How would this bill affect companies that rely a lot on immigrant labor?
Well, you know, that is a whole separate conversation in itself. This is more or less about dealing with folks at this point who are here and are, you know, quite frankly, the bad apples of the community. And we want to make sure that they're off the streets and that we're making sure that our communities are safe by removing them from the public.
Well, Texas senators are voting this week on a similar penalty-type measure for their counties, but that state doesn't give counties a lot of money, so there's not that much it can take away. Are you watching how this sanctuary city penalty is working through other states and legislatures and potential hurdles?
Well, you know, the federal dollars, I've seen a report, and, you know, it depends on whose number you use, but sure, now this, if the federal system is a completely different point. This is just, this bill has to do with the state level. It's, sometimes it's easy to mix up the two. So there's two different things here. And it's a great conversation to have. Let's talk about what needs to be done so that we're applying the law equally. Let's talk about making sure that we're upholding the existing laws. And, you know, if there are differentials or points of concern and funding issues, let's have that conversation now.
Well, what's the next step you're working on then with this bill?
Well, certainly there's a time frame as far as getting the information together. I'm seeing how many, what kind of support you have. And then there's a lot more conversation to have, a lot more opportunities for people to weigh in. And as we do that, you know, I'm sure we'll hear from both sides of the conversation.
Representative Branston, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, I appreciate the time to speak, and I always appreciate to represent the state of Wisconsin. Thank you so much.
That was Assembly Republican Janelle Branston from Menominee Falls.
This is Central Time.